From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andy Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools. So today we want to talk about an exam, right?
Yeah, so I was trying to prepare the future episodes and work out where we've been so we know where we're going, right? And when I reviewed the 29 episodes we've got, I went, hey, this is really, really close to the Windows Internals exam. And so we're going to go over the Windows Internals exam. And these are the books for the exam. Just go through what the exam expects of you and what information we've said in the show and what's kind of missing.
Okay.
And
before we get started, we have a question from last week, so we want to jump on that.
Yeah. Why can't you debug an IE ActiveX control in WoW 64? So it's further information, but I'm guessing he used the wrong debugger. So if you want to debug a 32-bit process, which is what WoW 64 means, you have to use the 32-bit debugger. And that's because it actually injects code into the process and it has to be the same bitness. So I'm guessing that's what the problem is. In Windows 8, the IE that you launch is 64-bit. But each of the tabs, which actually has the rendering and the ActiveX control embedded in it, is actually 32-bit.
Interesting.
And we do that for backwards compatibility because most ActiveX controls are 32-bit still, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so maybe they, one, attach to the wrong process, the parent one instead of the child, and two, they may have used the wrong bitness debugger. So make sure you use the one that's in debugger x86 folder.
Okay, and send an email to defragtools@microsoft.com if you still have problems with it. We'll help you out.
Definitely, and I'll post an answer here as well.
Cool.
So Windows Internals Exam, 7660. Came out in 2008. So
this covers, this doesn't get up to Windows 7 or Windows 8, right?
No, they were released after that date. So at this time, Vista was out, Windows 7 was still well and truly in development. 7 came out in 2010? 9?
9, I can't remember.
Yeah, anyway, it was still a long way out from this point.
After this, yeah.
So it's a little bit old, but it's fundamental. Questions are still valid. I mean,
so the exam is still a valid endeavor for someone who still wants to do it.
Yeah, when I rename this would be like Windows troubleshooting exam.
Yeah.
It's actually not really, I mean, you have to know about the internals of Windows to actually know how to troubleshoot it, but RISC is the only troubleshooting exam we have just for general troubleshooting of Windows.
And I would say most of the things in the Windows internals exam, I mean, Windows internals, like talking about the kernel and the low-level stuff, changes a little bit from mm-hmm. release, but not that much.
Yeah.
So even though this is a few years old, probably 90% of this stuff is still very relevant to Windows 8.
And so if you're studying for this exam, you probably wouldn't want to use the 6th edition of Windows Internal.
So 6th edition, which is two parts, I haven't got the second part here, part 1 and part 2, is on Windows 7. There is no Windows 8 book yet. The numbers are off by one. So Windows 7 is 6th edition, Vista and Server 2008 are 5th edition. As I said, both those things didn't really kind of exist when this was written. This book was released like in 2010. It was like 2 years late.
Mm-hmm.
And so these weren't really around when we designed the exam. Because of that, it was designed based on the 4th edition. Right?
Okay.
And so the content in the 4th edition is what really is expected of you. As Chad just said, 95% of it's the same. Smaller book, big book. I rather read the small book, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Also, you should be able to get that cheap, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
You should be able to find some.
Pick up a used copy.
And who writes the questions that are on the exam? Where do they come from?
So this exam was actually written by escalation engineers, so like me and Chad, and a guy called Jeff Daly, who's one of the big escalation engineers at Microsoft, ran the whole project. And there's 100 or something questions in the bag, and you get asked some proportion of that.
And if someone wants to take the exam, do they have to go someplace to do it? Or?
Yeah, standard Microsoft certified professional exam thing. So you go to like Prometric and those type of companies. You know, you book it 2 weeks in advance and then you get your, whatever it is, 1-2-3 hour window for the exam. It's a multiple choice exam.
Mm-hmm.
Just radio buttons the whole time. You sit and do it. And we've both done it. I did it only about 3 months after joining Microsoft, and I was okay at it. So you don't need that much experience in true, deep troubleshooting to be able to pass it. And actually, I did it when I was doing Exchange support, not Windows support. So a lot of the Windows stuff wasn't even applicable to me, and I still passed it quite easily. And you did it.
Yeah, I didn't study. I just went and took it. So it was, I think that...
Well, look at you.
Well... because it was written by someone who does my job.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So if you are if you have this stuff down, you're well on your way to doing, you know, an escalation engineer job at Microsoft. So
yeah, there is always openings.
Yeah.
Any tips for studying?
Practice rather than study.
Yeah.
So you know, actually crack open the debugger and actually debug a dump file or something like that, and do what we've done on this show. And if you actually did all the steps that we did in the last 29 shows, I'm pretty sure you could probably pass the exam right now.
Yeah.
If you understood that.
We're almost like a video series for the exam.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of.
Not really surprising that based on who's talking.
It's a lot of overlap between what we've covered and what would be on the exam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is just run through the objectives on the exam and probably point out some shows that we're good for that.
Okay.
There's a couple of empty points because we haven't talked about some of this ancient stuff, but mm-hmm. the exam's going to ask you, so we'll cover them quickly. So just jump into it. Architectural stuff, you know, non-page versus page memory. We've talked about that in the kernel space, how you can use bang pull and bang VM in the kernel to understand how much there is of the two, and particularly the usage. This is going to kind of repeat itself over and over again because it's going to say about the architecture and then it's going to say what tool do you use to look at that. So we'll revisit things a bit. MDLs, that's all yours. You're the kernel guy.
So MDLs are used primarily for DMA transfers. So I don't remember if we've talked very much about MDLs, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
But the main thing is you kind of got to know what they're for.
What's the TLA expansion for that?
The TLA, memory descriptor list.
Okay.
And so, so those are a list of physical pages that are used, that we pass it to a driver when we want to tell it where.
Yeah, I think we talked about DMA, but we never talked about the mechanism that we model that in, which is MDLs.
Yeah, so you pass a list of physical pages and say, hey, go get some data and stick it in this memory for me.
Yeah.
Here's the list.
Physical versus logical memory, so you know, RAM sticks versus the logical addressing of that stuff onto that. We've talked about that at length. You just have to know that physical memory really has no relationship to virtual memory at all. You can have model way more virtual memory than there is physical memory in the box. Associated with that is address translation, and we've talked about the PFN tables,
PTEs,
and PTEs,
page table entries,
and that's how you work out what virtual memory is mapped to a physical address, and it was bang PTE. Mm-hmm. Heap memory, which is a user mode process thing, that's your news, your mallocs, all those commands in both CLR and native programs. This exam's kind of before the CLR. It doesn't.
I don't think there's any managed stuff on it. Because it's kind of more of a low-level exam, more about the OS and the kernel and that sort of thing. Yeah. So that CLR is a little bit higher level in the architecture.
And I/O mechanisms. We haven't really gone into I/O that much. Maybe you want to give a two-minute explanation of plug and play?
Well, actually, we talked a little bit about it when we were showing the live debugging and we were like setting breakpoints on some of the driver entry points and things like that. So obviously plug and play is what allows you to plug devices in, unplug them, start them, stop them. And those are handled through IO request packets, ERPs. Mm-hmm. So you'd need to know what an ERP is. I think that's one of the other things on the list there. ERCL levels we've talked about in the context of
scheduling and stuff.
When interrupts come in. So when you're at a high ERCL level, we cannot schedule other things on the processor.
And we also talked about it in the locking episode as well. Mm-hmm. The IO manager, so this is the guy who roughly makes all these IO requests and stuff like that.
Makes it all happen.
Yeah. Device stacks. So we've done bang dev stack, and it will show you the drivers who are on top of each other and what logic a request is going to go through. So like an IO request packet is just like a block of work. And it's just passed from program to program to program. It's kind of like callbacks, I guess. You can analogize it too. It just happens to be this filter is responsible for calling the next filter who calls the next filter, which is what a filter driver is. Filter drivers sit in the middle and modify the packet. So you might, for example, compress it as it goes through, right? Or decompress it as it comes back out the other way. Or you may press this monitor. You might just remember it, right? Press this monitor sits in the middle and goes, hey, I saw this packet go through. I'll record it.
classic example of a filter driver is antivirus, where it'll scan for something bad and it won't let the I/O go through if it finds some signature of a virus.
Yeah. And timers, we did a lot on Bang Timer. And so that's all about how things fire at a certain time. Look at the scheduling episode for that. Subsystems, Object Manager. So we've done that a bit. We've done
WinObj.
And that's all. Here's all the objects that are available. Everything's defined by a name, for example. Cache Manager, as the name kind of implies, it caches files and stuff like that. It just remembers files as they go past. And as they expire, it actually keeps a reference on them. So they don't fall out of memory. And we've talked about cache a fair bit in talking about RAM map, and there was another episode, some kernel episode, we talked about that. Mm-hmm. Process Manager, it's a guy who worries about processes, thread creation, process creation, stuff like that. Memory Manager, we've talked about that a fair bit, allocating memory, worrying about physical versus virtual memory, worrying about pulling stuff in from the page file, stuff like that.
RAM map and VM map would probably not covered in the book, but they are useful for sort of learning about those concepts.
So if you're studying for this exam, should you use older version of the tools?
Nah. The tools haven't changed that much.
Okay.
Not enough to justify it. The only one in the list which has changed is XPerf, when we showed that last week.
Yeah.
Just use the old XPerf, the old looking at UI instead of the new fancy one, and then you're kind of in the right zone. They're not asking about what the switches are to these tools. They're just asking you what tool would you use in this situation.
Yeah.
So don't go in stress that you don't know every flag to some program. It's not about that. It's just knowing what tool to know to use when.
Yeah.
And nothing more than that. Security reference monitor. Guts of the security system, right? Everything's got an access control list associated with it, and this guy worries about making sure that everything's secure. Interrupts, process affinity, system service calls, and 64-bit. They all got talked about in the scheduling episode. Interrupts is when physical hardware fires, turns into DPCs, DPCs turn into work. That work usurps normal threads. Process affinity says, hey, I want this thread to only run on this core. Don't you let it move around. You do that for cache affinity reasons. It's usually a bad idea to set process affinity. System service calls, that's the transition between user mode and kernel mode, and that's that syscall that we've assembler command that we've called out a couple of times, and it's the boundary between user and kernel mode, and you change between the user stack and the user
the kernel stack.
That's done through a syscall. And 64-bit versus 32-bit, and we've gone through that at length, roughly different registers, wider bit width, and different amount of memory available. PEBs and TEBs, and I'll show that one quickly. That's kind of easy to... Whoops. I need to actually run the debugger.
I was wondering.
I'll type all the commands.
Type commands in a notepad.
A process has a PEB, a process environment block, and it has information about all the modules loaded, how long it's been running, the command lines and stuff like that it was ran with, and then a copy of the environment variables at launch. So if I change the environment variable now, unless this guy subscribes to an event to hear that, he won't see that change because he's got a copy of it at launch. And then per thread, there is a TEB, and a TEB is information about the thread itself, so you can find out what the stack is and stuff like that. And we've gone through that at length. Let me kill that. Thread scheduling, we've talked about that. States and priority states, running. The main ones to remember are running, ready, and waiting. The other ones are kind of transitory. And prioritization, we've talked about at length a couple weeks ago.
You even showed a chart or something.
Yeah. Optimizing a system for drivers, identifying filter drivers. How do you do that, Chad?
How do you identify filter drivers?
Yeah.
Well, you can see them in the debugger if you look at the dev stack.
Okay. Yeah. Timers and DPCs, Bang Timer gives you those, Bang DPCs gives you DPCs. System worker threads, that's those EX, what's the thread name? EX thread worker, is that what it's called? So in the kernel, instead of having every driver having its own pool of threads for work, there's a system one, and it's a pool of threads, and it's EXP worker thread is the function name. and you schedule it to that pool, you'll see it run as system. System's the user who runs those ones. And then when the work's finished, you'll get notified back in the device driver, so it's a pool of threads. If you see, like in Process Explorer is a good example, the system process going flat chat, odds are it's a system worker thread doing work. And driver verifier, Michael Foray came in and gave us three awesome episodes on that.
Yep.
Driver verifier, the simple answer is use it when anything in the kernel gets unstable, turn verifier on. Application verifier, we haven't covered yet. It's the same idea, but we do it for application level.
Yep.
And GFlags, so this is one of the things I wanted to show today specifically. So while...
I can't remember if we've showed GFlags.
We haven't yet.
Maybe briefly.
Yeah, not at great length. I did that so the long way. Windows XA is way faster.
So GFlags comes with the debugging, with the debugger package, debugging tools for Windows.
Yeah. There's two modes to this. There's changing the kernel stuff, which is really you turning on driver verifier level type stuff, and at the application level. So if I type notepad.exe and press tab, what that will read is the image file execution option page, software, like machine software, Microsoft. I'm going to go NT. Yeah, I'll go NT. 50-50 chance. There it is. And what that has done is, I haven't pressed save yet, but it reads these keys. And so these keys define a behavioral change for it. And so the operating system can apply all this logic onto things and change the behavior of applications. And it's saved in these keys. So I might say, create user stack trace database, which what it does is it records the stack every time a heap operation occurs. So you can look for memory leaks. So if I do that and then press apply, Notepad will now have that, and a global flag will be set, and that bit will be set. All right, and you can also do it on the command line instead of doing it in the GUI. So GFlags is about that. So when you have, you know, memory corruption or a memory leak, or all these other things, you can turn on various flags, and it will either crash the program when it happens, and you'll get it at the right point, and you can see the damage, or after the fact, you can take snapshots and see what's happening. So this one's, for example, enable heap tail checking. So this checks that the heap has never been overrun, right? That the tail signature is still valid, for example. Very analogous to the special pool that you get in the kernel.
You can turn on application verifier from right here as well.
Yeah, and there's lots of things you can do. We'll do a dive into that maybe one day. Mm-hmm. But just know that GFlags is used to set these abilities. Kernel versus user mode threads, we talked about at length. Structured exception handling. This was written before vectored exception handling became popular. So vectored exception handling is when you have one exception handler for all threads. Structured error handling, exception handling is for one thread. It's not try catch, that's a language primitive. It is underscore underscore try and underscore underscore catch. And that is the operating system level one. It's a failure to handle a structured error handler is what causes a crash, not a failure to. So a language one will escalate up into a OS one, and the OS one will then crash you with AE debug and stuff. Map memory files, we've talked about that with VMMap, how you use, sometimes you pull in data, you map a file on disk into memory, and you just address it as if it was memory, you don't know it's a file. Authentication, this is the obvious things, NTLM, Kerberos, stuff like that. Anonymous as well, and guest and all those things. Synchronization primitives, we've well and truly gone over that. Verify again, and application compatibility toolkit, and this is one where we should get Gove in one day and get Chris Jackson, the app compat guy, to come in and do an ACT thing. And what this does is it shims programs, and you can say, well, this program consistently doesn't know how to read the operating system version correct, and so it says, I'm not willing to run because this is not XP, right? And so the shim can lie to the program, and that's what the ACT does. It's a authoring tool to let you modify the way the operating system represents itself to a particular application.
It's the same thing as if you right-click on the EXE and choose thing, properties yeah. and lie
similar,
to it there.
Yeah, I think you can be a lot more granular with the ACT to like really specify
So you can lie particular. Really good.
Really yeah. good, yeah.
I think
yeah.
it's, I mean, the dialogue probably gives you, what, 10 options maybe? Mm-hmm. Well, I think what happens is when you choose one of those drop downs, they've predefined that, you know, these 20 shims apply.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a style, yeah. it's like a subset, or a grouping.
It's a line theme.
Yeah. And so ACT lets you do that. And yeah. there's Tech Ed speeches on ACT. Chris Jackson talks about it repeatedly at Tech Ed. So go watch that. And then GFlags again. IO models, asynchronous versus asynchronous. It's simple as, you know, if you do something like read file, right? You can, in the API, say, read the file. And what happens is all this IO stuff happens in the background. And it's your choice whether the read file function finishes and then you go away and then that happens in the background, or you, which is asynchronous, or you sit there and wait. If you sit there and wait, what happens is the OS just allocates a waiter behind the scenes and does it asynchronously anyway. But it puts this little layer of waiting. And so you'll always go into a wait state and then the IO will come off, go off and turn into DPCs and interrupts and stuff like that. And it'll come back and signal you that, hey, by the way, that read's finished. So that's asynchronous versus asynchronous. Most people should know that. IO completion ports go with that. So the thing that fires to say, hey, this operation's finished is an IO completion port. If you do it synchronous, we just write the code for you. If you do it asynchronous, then you're responsible for waiting on the completion port. And that's just a wait for multiple objects call. And then modding through the apps is kind of easy. Performance. I'm not going to go into Perfmon, quite frankly. If you don't know what Perfmon is, I don't know why you're watching this show. Disk IO. Well, is it true or not?
Talk.
Disk IO. Back in XP days and 2003 days, the disk counters were not turned on by default because they were too heavy. And so you actually have to, I don't know what the keys is off my head, but you have to turn on disk counters. It's a registry key, I think. So that's something you have to maybe go off and do a bit of research. If you want to track disk IO, it's one of those things where you just use Perfmon and stuff like that to track the physical disk counters and also the logical disk counters. So sometimes if you have two partitions on the same spindle on the same disk, you'll see thrash between them as you move from like C drive to D drive as the head seeks. So just be aware of a physical drive's performance can be different to a logical drive's performance. Application performance, you know, you're looking at CPU usage, and you're looking at memory usage, you're looking at all those things. And device I.O., bit different to disk I.O., it's more about network and stuff like that, other devices on your PC. Talking about monitoring I.O., you know, how do you monitor filter drivers and all those things. Most of this comes down to the actual monitoring is XPerf gives you about the only data available. Back in Windows 2003, there was a program called Kermrate, and if you do a search for it, you'll get a big, nasty warning from Microsoft saying
it's deprecated.
It's deprecated. Please use performance analysis tools, which is XPerf.
XPerf.
It only runs on XP. I didn't have an XP box to, you know, show it.
You should know it exists because I think it is still mentioned on the exam.
It is. And what Kermrate does is you run it and it monitors the system for a little while and it works out what stack is running the hottest. Right, and that's something you can also do in XPerf, and there's not enough time to do it today, but we'll go into that one day. But the very gist of it is you run XPerf and then you'll get CPU graph, you right click on the CPU graph, you sort it by stack, and then you'll see the hottest stack by percentage weight. So Kermrate, the other thing is, know that sometimes it's called KRView when you download it. All right? They might trick you up on that. Memory, again, on page, we talked about that. Debugging memory leaks, it's the approach. So, you know, you take differential snapshots. We showed in the VM map episode, and back in like episode 6, maybe, that if you take snapshots one after another, then do a comparison, you can look for leaks. Memory corruption, that's where you use things like the tail checking and stuff in GFlags to catch overruns, and you might do an underrun as well. And then associated with that is heap corruption. Anything you want to add there for that one? No?
For like memory corruption and heap corruption, you kind of want to know that you'd use, you can turn on those heap flags through GFlags or app verifier. For kernel memory corruption, you would want to know about driver verifier and a special pool, mm-hmm. which I think we've covered a little bit.
Yeah. And I don't know if we covered it, but if you go into the debugger, what's the command? Bang heap minus V for verification, and it will verify the structure of the heap. So if you get a crash, you do heap minus V, and it will make sure that everything's good, and it will point out all the memory allocations that have been bad, and then maybe from the contents of that, you could work out, well, I allocated Quidjibo, well, Quidjibo is only used on this line of code over here. That must be the person who overran it. Mm-hmm. Monitoring CPU, be aware that, you know, CPU is journaled as kernel and user time. We've seen that in Bang Thread. When you're in user mode, you get journal time. When you're in kernel mode, you get journal time, so you can see the difference. And then Task Manager, you can see it. I can't see it anymore in Windows 8. Actually, just there, show kernel times. So you get a little dark blue area now. And then you get that. In good old days, it was the red line. The red and green lines, and it was the red line.
Yeah, they changed the display a little bit in Windows 8.
Yeah. Thread states, bang thread again, waiting, running, ready. Perfmon, you're looking at things like per thread CPU usage. And when you're in XPerf particularly, you can look at C states a lot more and stuff like that. Once again, kernel rate's a way of saying that. Crashing stuff. So, back in this old time, there used to be the only way of the only way of catching a dump. Really, this is before procdump and before debug diag came out. There is a script. Now it's called exe. On the exam, it will say adplus.vbs. It has been superseded, and they renamed it to 80plus_old. So what you see as old is 80plus.vbs in the exam. No, I don't want to change that. I don't know what that means. Anyway, so what you can do is, much like with procdump, you can attach to a process and wait for hangs. And a hang is a hang dump, like take a dump right now. Minus crash is wait for a crash. So minus E in procdump. Very simplistic. This is why procdump was written, because this was a little bit too basic. And then all these other programs came along, and then 80plus.exe was written to kind of remove the need for procdump, and that's what happened. So use it for crash dumps. Dr. Watson, we've talked about. Back in these days, it's minus P percentage LD minus E percentage LD. It's just two parameters. In Vista and higher, and what procdump uses, which is not in the exam, is three parameters. So what you have to remember is Dr. Watson can be used to do minus P percentage LD minus E percentage LD. This can be used for attaching and crashes. This can be used just for crashes, which is the AE debug key, which is right here. And we've talked about that. This is the debugger key, these ones. So this would have Dr. Watson in it. Windows Error Reporting, that was relatively new at the time of the exam. Windows Error Reporting is where I think everybody's familiar with it these days. You can set group policy or local policy to say, keep this many dumps, upload it to Microsoft, don't upload it to Microsoft, all that type of stuff.
We had Graham on this to talk a little bit about that too.
Yeah. Default postmortem debuggers, which is now Werfault in Vista and higher. It was Dr. Watson 32 in XP, and that's us. And they said you could, instead of having procdump in here, you could do WinDBG minus I to install it as the postmortem debugger. Dr. Watson, the command line you'll need is Dr. Watson 32 minus I. That's how you install it, and so that will pop up the debugger. And we've talked about that in the very first WinDBG episode about opening files. This is like episode 12, around there somewhere. And exception handling we've gone through. And then we're kind of back into repetitive of what we've talked about. UMDH is a program that you can use to, which is user mode dump heap. When you turn on stack heap in GFlags, it sets up a database of all these heap allocations. And then what you do is you can take two snapshots, and then you can get the tool to diff the snapshots. It's all text-based on the command line. And then it will show you, hey, this function between here and now has leaked 12K or wherever it is. The UMDH page on MSDN or TechNet is really good. It really gives you a clear run through. So when you're studying for the exams, just go read that once, understand what the tool can do. User stack tracing, roughly the same thing. That's how the UMDH actually gets its data. WinDBG, you can do the same thing, get all the same information out. Application Verifier, once again, same thing. GFlex, is how you set it, once again, same thing. Perfmon, once again, same thing. They're all kind of analogous to each other. Heap corruption, page heap, bang heap minus V. Application Verifier turns it on, GFlex turns it on. Okay. Handle leaks, Procmon. We've talked about Procmon before, how you can see operations being made and lost. Also, here should be presses explorers here. And one of the things we haven't done is handle. So let's do that guy. Is this elevated? Sysinternals tool. Handle actually has the Presses Explorer device driver in it. And so you want to keep the two in sync because you don't want an old. Like run handle first, puts an old device driver on the box, and you try to run a new Presses Explorer GUI, you won't get to in sync. So handle can do the same thing that Presses Explorer can do in the lower pane. It will show you that for every process, every handle that it's got.
Command line oriented version of that functionality.
Yeah, Mark actually tends to do that a lot. He tends to write all these new tools as a command line first, and then when he works out that it's all stable and good, he'll merge it into the GUI apps, which obviously takes a lot more effort. So that's how you do handle leaks. We haven't done it, but there's a thing called htrace, bang htrace in the debugger. You enable it, you run something, you break in, and you do a minus diff, htrace minus diff, D-I-F-F, and it will show you all the handles that have leaked or changed since that point. T-list. T-list is part of the debugging tools. It lists every process on the box, and if I choose a...
there's a way to do a services thing with that too.
Is there?
Yeah.
If I choose a process, it will give me the threads within it. We'll give more information about it. PS list is the other one, which I don't know if it's on the exam, but which is the sysinternals way of doing it. And it'll give you a little bit more information. Where's my Egon? Where are we up to? Handles, and then tlist is as a thread list, which is listing processes and threads. Lotus Snap.
I think it's task list.
Oh, task list, yeah. DLL dependencies, depends.exe is part of Visual Studio. Application manifests, you can put a .man file associated with an exe and change the behavior. It's more of a CLR thing. 64-bit, 32-bit, we've done that. Load issues, this actually is analogous to the question we got asked today. You can only load a 32-bit DLL in a 32-bit process. And then task list is that the same thing?
That's a good question.
Yeah,
anyway. I'm not sure.
Services. So services, not that many people, I think, use SC.
I tend to use just this, NetStart, NetStop to start and stop services.
So SC query will tell you all the services on the box, and you can say query Windows, Windows search, and it will say, it's currently running, it's able to be stopped, it can't be paused, and it allows to be shut down. And I don't know, there's command lines to find out who it's dependent on. So it will show you these services must be started before I can run, and these other services depend on me to be started before they can run. And so
it's sort of the command line version of the services, MSC.
Yeah. Yeah, the GUI thing.
GUI thing, yeah.
Fool around with that. The one thing that you can do is, if you look at an SVC host, you know how you impress, that's not what I want. Presses Explorer, when you hover over a service, you get all of the services. So you can go type equals own, and you can actually pull out one of these services and put it into its own process. So if you see that one of these is being misbehaving, you change its launch type to go as a type equals own, and it will have its own exe. And that way, if there's memory corruptions and stuff, it only hurts itself and it's easy to diagnose.
I find that I tend to do that if I'm debugging a service, because typically you have some service host with, you know, 10 different services in it. If you're just trying to debug one service, you can get all this other mess going on, and it's just much more complicated. So it's just easier to put it in its own service host.
Yeah. Services control panel, we just talked about that. Service dependencies, we just talked about that. Isolation, so that's what we just talked about. Startup types, so there's back in this point in time, there's manual, disabled, and automatic. In Vista, it may give you this question, there's all now automatic delayed. So it waits, is it 5 minutes? I always forget what time it is. You know, it waits a period.
A couple of minutes.
Yeah.
That lets you start up your machine faster and
that was
kick
the
it
idea,
up later.
Because the idea before was you'd get all these services starting up right on boot, and mm-hmm. you'd kind of thrash your hard drive and your CPU really.
And the user has to sit and wait.
You got to wait. So if you have services, you always want to start, but they don't have to be there right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Set them to start up delayed, automatic delayed start.
So, and then the next thing was registry. So it's under system, current control set, services. Device drivers are also services, and the rest have got their own type. If we look for that Windows search one I just used, there it is. The name that's used in the command line matches the registry key here. And here's all the parameters, the DLL names. And once this is the DLL-based one, so it goes into SVC host.
You can see that one is set to delayed auto start.
Yeah. So be aware of that. RPCs are used to do communication between boxes. LPCs are exactly the same as an RPC, but it never leaves the box. Shared memory, that's map memory, so you can map the same memory in multiple processes. We went through that in VMAP episode. Name pipes, it's like a socket, but it's a pipe. I can't explain it any better than that.
It's a name instead of a number.
Go to Wikipedia and look it up if you don't understand.
process, it's an old NetBIOS thing.
Yeah, process startup, I'm not sure why that's in there, and then WinSock is traditional sockets. How to analyze executable modifications. So WinDBG, what you can do is there's a command called check image, C-H-K-I-M-G, and what it will do is it will compare the in-memory version to what's on disk, and it will work out if it's been changed in between the two. It will also download the executable or the DLL from Microsoft.com if it's indexed, and will compare what's on the disk to what's on Microsoft.com so you can work out if something's been changed. Not the biggest issue these days because everything's digitally signed from a file system point of view, but from a in-memory point of view, many, many applications like to go and rewrite all your assembler on you.
Well, the other thing that you'll see sometimes is if you have bad RAM, and you get a crash, and you suspect that there may be bad RAM involved. Especially if you go and look at the dump file, and it looks like you're just executing code that makes no sense, or maybe isn't even code, do a bang check image on it, because what may have happened is that the executable in memory may have gotten corrupted by
as Dan cosmic rays.
Cosmic rays, or just some other kind of weird kernel mode memory corruption. But check image will let you sort of identify that.
Yeah. Detours is a Microsoft Research technology. It's actually how a VMAP works. It's a sanctioned way to rewrite someone's code. And that's what that is. And you can see with check image, it'll show you there's a difference here, and you'll see the detour in place. Hot patching, it's not used that much for various reasons. What we do is we leave a hold of NOOPS, N-O-P, space before every function call in the kernel. And then that gives us enough space to we wipe the first assembly instruction 8 bytes, so 8 bits worth, 1 byte, do a jump upwards, and then there's enough space in that little section to write a hot patch to vector off somewhere else, change the way the code runs, and then come back.
The idea with this was to allow you to put hot fixes on a running server without having to reboot or even stop the program. And it's a little more complicated than I think they originally thought, and it's not used very often, but there are I think a couple of patches out there over the years that have used it. Anyway, you just need to know that it exists.
Yeah, and just look at the assembly. If you don't see no ops before a function call, it means someone's put code there, because everything's got this space in it.
Well, a lot of times you'll see things that aren't actually the NOOP instruction, like NOP, but there are some sort of meaningless instruction, like move EDI, or something like move something into itself.
Kind of like a operation.
Doesn't do anything, but it's just there to take up space so that we can overwrite it with something else.
Like A equals A.
Yeah, exactly.
SPI++, so GUI programs are based on messages, Windows messages, and it's kind of abstracted away these days in CLR days, but underneath everything there's a pump, there's a message pump, and it receives and you emit messages, like the mouse message comes in, or the button press message comes in. And this message is, it's a structure and it's interpreted. And so you can see every single one of them fly by with a program called SpyPass+, which is inside Visual Studio. Message queues, I'm not really sure what that, I'm assuming that's meaning MSMQ, maybe. Oh no, this is probably message queues, as in Windows message queues.
I think it must be talking about Windows messages.
I'm sure there's a debugger extension. I don't know what it is, but I don't do GUI. Yes. I don't do GUI.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
SpyPlus+ is still used fairly often for those kinds of things.
Once again, application verifier can be used to interrogate those things. Trace tools, I have no idea what that is. Someone go Google it. I'll go Bing it. Whoops, I said the G word.
$20 in the jar.
ATL trace, anything that's written with ATL. ATL is... the ActiveX template library, it's part of C++, came out in, I don't know, 96, around there, and it's how a lot of programs were written in C++ days. Not as used as much anymore. STL's kind of taken over, and it's a replacement of MFC. There is a program called ATL Trace that will trace all the ATL operations, though. A lot of COM applications, so like DCOM stuff, ActiveX control, stuff like that, are written in ATL, and so you can use ATL Trace to work out what function calls are happening. It kind of extracts away a lot of the message handling, so it will write the message pump for you and just call your function like a callback, much like you would in the CLR, and so it will show you all that translation happening under the surface. And good old Task Manager.
Task Manager, we did an episode on that.
Yeah. Object Manager, WinOverJ, we did that. Symbolic links, which is links to other things. The most obvious one around is your C drive. So, C colon is actually just a map to a real device object. Object namespace, that's kind of that thing. Security descriptors, everything's controlled by security. If it's an object or a file or whatever, everything's secured. Global namespace, that's the what I was just showing there. It's available to all users. And then you have the object namespace, which is your own namespace, so per user. So IC network.
Session based.
Yeah, session based. So I see shares that I've opened, but you won't see shares in your session, for example. Device objects, file objects, object manager, it's all that stuff. Just play around with the WinOverJ for 5 minutes, you'll be good. Remove failures and stuff like that to do with plug and play, look at your event log, stuff like that. A lot of these questions on the exam are, what tool should you use? And the answer is the event log, because it's there. Mm. Don't try going to the nth degree, oh, I should get a kernel dump, and then I'll look at this buffer, and no, it's just in the event log. Know that plug and play is used to add and remove devices. Devices are registered in the namespace, stuff like that. And that worries about panel handling, which you've kind of gone over a bit. Pool corruption, much like before with heap corruption, we use verifier tools to turn on boundary checking. We use WinDBG commands to look at it. Use pool tags and pullmon. We keep on mentioning pullmon, but we have never run it. And today is our lucky day. Oh, where's Dflex?
Maybe not our lucky day.
I ran this last night. Oh, I ran it on my Windows 7 partition on this. I'll reboot quickly and get into that.
And if you're still with us, what happened right there is you were going to show us Pullmon.
Yeah.
Because we haven't talked about Pullmon.
I tried it on Windows 8.
Now we know why we haven't talked about Pullmon.
Yeah, I tried it on Windows 7.
Didn't
I couldn't find it. You have to install the DDK, or the WDK. It's part of the WDK.
And we don't have that here on this machine. Mm-hmm. So we're not showing you Pullmon.
We may cover that in a future episode.
Yeah.
On a very special episode of Defrag Tools.
That's right. That's a very special message.
Let's move on. All right, so pool leak, same thing. Just look at page and non-page pool growth. You can use RAMMAP for that. S-state failures, when you translation between power states, you get all these ERPs, which Chad talked about.
So S-states are basically the system's power state, overall power state.
Yep.
S0 is totally on, S3 is standby, S4 is hibernate, S5 is power off.
Yeah, and most of these will be in the event log if something goes wrong. CPU utilization, kern rate, as I said, it's the old program which I can't run on Windows 8, WinDBG, just look at the CPU journaling of the time on each thread. Deadlocks, band deadlock can help you here, and just look for synchronization objects that are waiting for each other. Performance monitoring, look at the kernel time versus user time in Perfmon. And event tracing, I'm not sure why event tracing is there, but you can use process monitor a bit to help you here.
Or XPerf.
Oh, XPerf, of course. Yeah. And then we're up to the last section, debugging. We've kind of gone through all these already. I mean, analyzing memory, you know, bang address, bang pull, bang heap, all those things. Dumping stacks, use K, use KV. Crash dumps, ECXR, ECR, CXR. ECXR is the main one, a crash dump, and then you're looking for corruption of the instruction pointer or a bad read or a bad write. Pending I.O., once again, use debugging for that. Thread state, bang thread, you're looking for wait, ready, running. Synchronization objects, we did bang object and all those shows, which particularly the one that you can dive into is critical sections, bang CS. Runaway. So bang runaway is one of the commands you can use. Actually, is a command that will show you in a user process who's the hottest thread. So the top one will be the hottest. It's sorted descending. When you're doing runaways, you can work out this thread's being scheduled so much because its priority is so high. Right? And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Same. It may be stuck in there because of a process affinity setting. Use performance monitor and kern rate and also XPerf to see those things. Crash dumps, you're looking at, be aware that DPCs are flying around and that that's kind of like the work object of the kernel rather than a thread. A DPC actually finds a thread and then just cuts into it and then does its work and then comes back, puts it back to how it was and then continues on, kind of like a stealth thread. Be aware that you're looking at assembler. I've kind of stressed that a couple of times. Forcing kernel crash dumps, crash on NMI, crash on control scroll, not my fault, are the main three. Also killing CSRSS, a critical object or critical process. If you kill one of those, it will bring down the box. Trap processing, understand that when you transition between a normal thread and a DPC or something like that, a trap will be inserted, which is just all the registers. Dot trap will move you back in time to what happened then. Register usage, IP is used for the instruction pointer, it's what code you're running. SP, stack pointer, it's what point in the stack you're up to. AX, BX, CX, DX are four main data ones. Be aware that in 64-bit we now use R9 to R13 more. In 32-bit you would have used pushed it onto the stack instead. Stack composition, prologue, epilogue, we haven't really gone into that, but roughly the idea is you push on data, call into the function, and then the function that you go into knows to call back in time for that. The call instruction pushes on an address, the ret address pulls that off, and that's where you will continue on. That's why when you're looking at stack, it's always one function after the one that you called. User dumps. Roughly everything I just said is repeatable for that. And setting up the debugger, Chad did a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
And that's the end. Whew, that was a long episode.
So now you can take the test.
Good luck. And
after you watch all the other
videos.
Read
this book.
Read that book, and then for the couple of things which we pointed out, UMGH and kern rate, download them, play with them, and you'll be good.
And if you have any questions, email us at defragtools@microsoft.com, and we will see you next week.
Have a good week.
Bye.